She wipes crumbs from the corners of her mouth.
Nah,
he smiles. You don't have to outrun La Migra. You only have to be faster than your brother. I got it covered. In your dreams, gordo, the brother says. What about you, hermana, and your son? What will you do if La Migra comes? Now it's Lydia's turn to lie back on her pack. Technically, La Migra can't send them anywhere because they're Mexican. And unlike Nando and many of the other migrants, they're traveling in their own country. They can't be deported. But Lydia knows that technicality won't help them at all if La Migra here happened to work for Los Jardineros. She shudders. We'll manage, she says. Nando nods and smiles encouragingly at Luca. Of course you will, he says. At length, the migrants sitting or lying on the rails stand up and make the announcement to the others. They can feel reverberations in the track. The train is coming. Luca goes and puts his hand on the rail, but feels nothing. It stopped down the line somewhere, chiquito, Nando says. It'll be along shortly. When a few minutes have passed, another man calls Luca over. Feel now, he says, and Luca obeys, placing his hand on the hot metal. He can feel the energy of the train percussing through the waiting steel. He draws his hand instinctively in and backs away from the rails to return to Mami's side. In the clearing, there's a flurry of activity among the migrants, who will now attempt to board. Everyone gathers their belongings and scatters across the area. They lay claim to their own patches of ground, spreading out, giving one another space to run alongside the train. They watch also for La Migra, which tends to time its raids to coincide with the train's arrival. After 2 days of undercover waiting, more migrants are suddenly visible, emerging from their hiding places to attempt the perilous flying start. Lydia quickly rolls up the blanket and straps it to the bottom of her pack. Then she turns to make the straps on Luca's shoulders as tight as possible. The tails hang down his legs. She ties them in a knot and tucks the loose ends into his waistband. She shifts her weight nervously from foot to foot. You want to do this, mijo? She asks him. She hopes he'll say no. She hopes he says, Mommy, this is crazy. I don't want to die. I'm scared. But Luca just looks at her. He doesn't respond at all. Maybe we'll try, she says. Let's just watch first. We'll see what happens. She feels sick with dread. When the train rounds the distant bend and comes into view, when Lydia can look down the track at its approaching nose, it appears to advance in slow motion. We can do this, she says to herself. It's not going that fast. It's loud as it pulls into the clearing. She can feel the chug in her bones, in her sternum, and many of the men step into a trot alongside. It's a challenge of competing details, all equally important, and Lydia finds herself rapt as she watches, trying to learn the techniques. You must match your speed to the train's speed, she sees, adjusting as you go. You must find the ideal point of axis, a protrusion, a ladder, a spot with plenty of grip, and some way to quickly get to the roof of the car. You must fully commit to your position once you've chosen it. You must defend it from other migrants whose urgency matches your own. Under no circumstances can you attempt to change course once you're underway. But you must also be mindful of tree limbs and other fixed hazards that threaten your track. You must pay close attention to what's ahead of you on the ground. You must take care not to step in a hole or trip over a rock while you run, not to stumble beneath the grinding wheels of the beast. You must never, ever forget the power of those churning, groaning, clattering, rumbling wheels. They shriek as a reminder. Que Dios la bendiga, their new friend calls out as he leaves them and begins to run alongside the train. His brother trots along behind him, their pace more than a jog, less than a sprint. Nando runs, oscillating his head to both watch where he's going and assess the train cars behind for a good spot to climb on. He sees a ladder coming, two cars away. He slows down, one car away. He picks up his pace, glances in front of him, ducks beneath the slapping limb of a leafy shrub. He reaches for the ladder, wraps his fingers around the third rung. He takes two strides, three, four, with only his right hand on the ribs of La Bestia. And then, all at once, he swings his full weight from that arm. He reaches his left arm up now as well, his hand in a brief panic until his fingers find their target and seize. Now his body is caught, suspended. This is the moment of paramount risk. The arms attached, clinging, hauling, the body draped like a flag, the legs hanging low, not yet clear of the wheels. "Get up!" the pot-bellied brother shouts. "Get your feet up!" he runs. And the instinct is to reach with those feet, to feel for what's beneath, to scrabble for perches, to find some way to boost your weight from below. But no, you must curl. Bring the feet up, up, up. Nando's feet find the bottom rung. His arms stretch up to the next, and now he's climbing. Strong, solid. A few more seconds. Slap! A passing tree branch threatens his grasp, scratches his side. But now he's safe. He's over the lip, and he lies down on top, offering a hand over the edge toward his brother, who is running now, below. Lydia's eyes are wide, and now the brothers are gone. The other migrants around them dwindling in numbers as they board, one by one, two by two. She crushes Luca's hand in her vice-like grip, but doesn't notice how hard she's squeezing it, and he doesn't protest. They are rooted in place, unmoving, until all at once, every echo of the train is gone. They walk. There's a new reverence to having seen it with their own eyes, the unfeeling crush of the wheels along their rails, the men clinging to the exoskeleton like beetles on a window screen. In the back seat of Papi's orange Volkswagen Beetle in Acapulco, Luca had his own little safety harness system, a bright blue cushion with monkeys on it that Papi had unfolded and somehow permanently affixed to the seat. When he was little, Luca liked the monkeys, the cushioned straps that went over his head, and then around his waist. He felt snug in there. But last summer, he started begging to be rid of the thing. It was babyish, he insisted. He was big enough to wear a regular seatbelt now, he said. Luca watches the last hip of the now silent train disappear around a distant bend and cannot make sense of anything. Chapter 12. Even if they knew how long it might be before the next train, they cannot conceive of boarding La Bestia now that they've seen how it's done. Lydia thinks it over while they walk the 7 miles to Huehuetoca. Would she put Luca on the ladder first? She would have to. There's no way she could jump on and leave him standing beneath the train without her. Could she run and climb on if he held onto her neck, his legs wrapped tightly around her waist? It seems physically impossible. Each time she tries to picture it, the fantasy ends the same way. Butchery. Luca distracts himself from how tired his legs are becoming by looking at the unusual sights. They pass a place that's full of every kind of statue. Bears, lions, cowboys, dolphins, angels, crocodiles. They pass some men who are laying bricks to build a wall. They pass a woman who's vacuuming instead of sweeping her front step, which makes Luca squeeze Mommy's hand so she'll see it too. When they pass a school and Luca sees some kids playing football in the yard, he realizes it's Thursday and that he should be in school in Acapulco and Papi should be picking him up this afternoon because Thursday is Papi's day to pick him up. And sometimes Papi buys him galletas and they eat them on the way home if he promises not to tell Mommy. After that, Luca doesn't look at the sights anymore. He watches his feet even though the sun feels hot on the back of his neck, and it takes them almost 3 hours to walk to Huehuetoca. When they arrive, they easily find the place they're looking for, as it sits neatly beside the railroad tracks behind a wind-whipped green fence. The Casa del Migrante is a gathering of tents and simple structures on a large, flat parcel of land that's saved from being beautiful only by the utilitarian character of its buildings. The wide road that separates the casa from the railroad tracks is of dirt and rubble, and it's empty as far as Luca can see. It's flat here for a long stretch, but in the distance, when he allows his eyes to follow the tracks to the horizon, Luca can see the landscape erupt upward on both sides. The clouds, puffy and brilliant, come down to meet it. There are ball fields all around and behind the casa, and on the far side of the tracks as well. But Luca can see that the soil has been tended, turned, striped with darker bands of earth where the farmers will sow their crops at the right season. There's a rich mineral scent on the wind. Luca and Lydia cross the parched road hand in hand and approach the chain-link fence that's been woven through with strips of green plastic so it's no longer transparent. Three strings of barbed wire cut through the air atop the fence, and two signs hang beneath it. The first is a cloudy, sunstruck blue and has a painting of Jesus and Mary, so Luca expects it to be a blessing, but it says, "Brother migrant, we will watch over you and protect you from polleros, guides, and coyotes so that you may enjoy a happy stay here with our hospitality. Anyone found to be in transgression of these specifications will be handed over to the appropriate authorities. May God protect you on your journey." The second sign is much less flowery, a list of rules written in a plain black font, so long that it's only decoration. A red banner at the very bottom sits in direct contact with the dirt below. "Welcome, brother and sister travelers." Luca reads some of the rules at random. "Persons requesting admission to the casa must be migrants from this country or other countries or deportees from the United States. Drugs and alcohol are prohibited. Anyone presenting symptoms of their use will be denied entry. Please remember that this is a place of sanctuary. Here you may rest while God restores your strength for the journey yet ahead of you. Your stay here must therefore be transitory and limited to a maximum of 3 nights. Before he can finish reading the list, two men greet them from the far side of the fence. Only their heads are visible above the green plastic stripping. One is an older man with dark glasses and gray hair, and he does the talking. "Bienvenida, hermana," he says. He steps closer to the fence so now Luca can see his shoulders as well, between the strings of barbed wire. He's wearing a dark blue cardigan and he smiles at them. "You're in need of shelter?" Luca nods. "You are migrants?" Lydia nods, reluctantly claiming the word. "Here," the man says kindly, gesturing to his stocky younger companion to open a gate a few feet away. "Please come in." Inside the fence sits an unpainted cinder block building with open-air windows covered in sheets of black tarpaulin. It's ugly, and its bleak shadow steals into Luca and thieves the relief right out of him. The older man folds his hands and speaks softly. "Are you in any immediate danger?" Lydia thinks before she answers. "No, I don't think so. Not right now." "Do you have any immediate medical needs?" "No, we are healthy."
Gracias a Dios,
the man says. Thank God, Lydia agrees. Are you thirsty? He turns to walk, indicating that they should follow.
Yes, a little.
They round the corner of the ugly gray building, and suddenly the space opens around them. Luca's lungs fill up with the rush he'd been waiting for. The chain-link fence that surrounds the entire compound is opaque only at the front, so he can see now, beyond its boundaries in the back, across the bare cornfields to the town of Huehuetoca nearby, its houses clustering merrily up the hillside. Large, prickly pear plants gathering clumps just outside the fence, their wide paddles cartoonishly green in the golden afternoon. The compound is much bigger than it looked from the road. There's one white van, a small house, a chapel, a string of porta-potties, and two gigantic warehouses.
Welcome to the Casa del Migrante, San Marco d'Aviano. I am Padre Rey.
This is one of my helpers, Nestor. Nestor raises one hand in salute, but doesn't look at them. He keeps his eyes on Padre Rey's black sandals.
We will get you something to drink right away, and you can freshen up for a few minutes.
Luca tucks his thumbs nervously beneath the straps of his backpack.
Hermana Cecilia will get you registered after you've had a little rest.
Thank you, Padre, Lydia says. God bless you for your kindness.
They step inside the first of the two warehouse buildings, and even though it's well lit, it takes Luca's eyes a few minutes to adjust. It's the first time he's been out of the stark sunshine all day. At a table, a boy and a girl, both younger than Luca, are coloring. The girl turns her head this way and that, admiring her artwork. A group of men and women sit at another table, some cleaning and sorting beans, others peeling carrots. Bright orange shreds collect in piles on the table. In the farthest corner of the large room, more men are watching football. Luca and Lydia choose an empty table and sit on lime-green plastic chairs. A lady with a red coverall apron brings them two glasses of cold lemonade. It has an umber tint, but Luca gulps it gratefully anyway.
Dinner is at 7, the woman explains apologetically. We can't make any exceptions unless it's a medical emergency.
It's after 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and they haven't eaten since the tortillas beside the tracks early this morning. But,
no, it's okay, we're fine, Lydia says.
Thank you.
As the woman returns to the kitchen, Lydia is swamped with emotion. She swallows it with the lemonade. She examines the faces of the people at the other tables, but no one looks at her. Hermana Cecilia soon appears and brings them to her small office. She's a tidy little woman, and her office is papered with children's artwork. A pot on her desk holds a pink plastic flower. There are green chairs just like the ones in the big room. Hermana Cecilia's voice is the most soothing sound Luca has ever heard, a peaceful, uninflected hum of determined protection, so that no matter what words she says, the words Luca hears are,
"You are safe here. You are safe here. You are safe."
From a shelf behind her desk, she produces a tub of crayons and a small stack of clean white paper.
"Would you like to stay here and draw?"
she asks Luca with her hum voice.
"Or sit in the big room with the other children?"
Luca's hand shoots out and grabs Mommy's.
"It's okay," Hermana Cecilia says. "You can stay with your mommy."
Lydia stands to pluck the backpack from his shoulders. She encourages Luca to sit at the other desk, beside the door.
"This way you can color," she says. "You won't have to hold the paper on your lap."
Luca sits and Lydia returns to sit across from the nun, who has some paperwork and a file folder in front of her.
"Before we begin, I want you to know that you don't have to answer anything that makes you uncomfortable. I ask that you try because the answers you give will help us assist more people in the future, to prepare for new patterns of arrivals. but all the information we gather here is anonymous. You needn't give your real name unless you want to. Lydia nods her consent. The nun lifts the cap of her pen, and they begin. Names and ages? Lydia gives a little twist of her neck before she responds. I'm 32, and my son is 8. Hermana Cecilia writes down, Maria, 32, y José, 8. Where are you traveling from? She hesitates, then asks a question of her own. No one has access to these files? Hermana Cecilia folds her hands and leans slightly forward. I assure you, hermana, whatever, whoever you're worried about will never see these files. The only copy is kept locked in that filing cabinet, in this office, also locked, whenever I'm not here. Her eyes are blue, and they twinkle when she smiles. I'm always here. Lydia nods. We come from Acapulco. The nun returns to her writing. What is your intended destination?
We're going to Estados Unidos.
What city?
Denver.
A friendly city, the nun says. Pretty there. Are you traveling for reasons of being reunited with a member of your immediate family?
No.
Do you have family members currently living in the United States?
Yes, an uncle and 2 cousins.
She hasn't seen that uncle, Abuela's younger brother, since she was a young girl. She's never met his children.
There in Denver?
Hermana Cecilia asks.
Yes.
They are expecting you?
No.
Was your decision to migrate planned or spontaneous?
Spontaneous.
Lydia squeezes her clasped hands together between her thighs. Was the primary reason for your journey financial?
No.
Was the primary reason for your journey medical?
No.
Was the primary reason for your journey domestic violence?
No.
Was the primary reason for your journey related to gang violence or recruitment?
No.
Lydia shakes her head. Was the primary reason for your journey related to violence by a cartel or drug traffickers in your place of origin? Lydia clears her throat.
Yes,
she says quietly. She can hear Lucas Crayon moving rapidly across the paper in silky strokes. Are you currently in fear for your life from a specific individual or individuals?
Yes.
Have you received direct threats to your safety? Lydia nods.
Yes.
Were the threats violent in nature?
Yes.
Can you describe the threats? Lydia scoots her chair closer and places her elbows on the edge of the desk. She folds her fingers together and lowers her head and her voice. The cartel killed 16 members of our family, she says, staring at the pen. The nun does not look up from her paper. They came to a family party and they shot everyone. My husband, my mother, my sister and her children. Everyone. We escaped. Hermana Cecilia's pen is at a momentary loss. It hangs suspended over the page for a few seconds before the nun can make it move again. She scribbles everything down and then makes her voice go again, too. Has your spontaneous migration resolved the immediate threat to your safety and well-being? Lydia hesitates because everything she's ever thought about protecting Luca has changed now. She doesn't want him to be afraid, but she needs him to be very afraid. And in any case, how can anything she does or does not say make any impact on him after what's already happened? She shakes her head. No, she admits. We are still in danger. You feel the threat has followed you? Lydia nods very slightly.
Yes, I mean, he doesn't know where we are right now,
but it was a very powerful man who did this. His influence extends all the way to El Norte, and he won't stop looking until he finds us.
Do you know which plazas belong to him or who his allies are in other organizations? The nun asks. Do you know which routes are safe for you to travel without his halcones? Lydia feels that this room has the sanctity of a confessional.
No, she whispers. I don't know. I don't know.
You are a long way from home, the nun says. He cannot find you here. You are safe here. Lucas Crayon makes no sound behind her. The nun puts her pen in the cup beside her phone and tucks the paperwork into the folder. Then she stretches her hands across the desk toward Lydia, who takes them in hers and bows her head. When Lydia closes her eyes, she realizes her hands are trembling. Hermana Cecilia's fingers are cool to the touch. Padre Nuestro, bless these children with your love and grace. Protect them from any further harm, God, and provide them with comfort in their time of unspeakable grief. May Jesus walk the road with them and repair their broken hearts. May Mother Mary sweep all dangers from their road ahead and lead them safely where they're going. Padre Nuestro, these two faithful servants have shouldered more than their share of life's burdens already. Please, God, may you see fit to relieve them of any further torment, yet not as we will it, but as thy will be done. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen,
Lydia says. Behind her at the little desk, with closed eyes and clutched crayon, Luca is moving his lips. Hermana Cecilia leans forward one last time. Be careful who you talk to, she says. That night, Lydia wakes to the sound of raised voices in the corridor. She sits up in the half-light of the bunk room and notices several other women popping up from their beds as well. They move silently to check on their children, who sleep through the ruckus. Luca is above her in the top bunk, so Lydia has to disentangle her leg from the backpack strap she wrapped around it before she fell asleep. She stands, her bare feet cool against the tile floor, and reaches for his rumpled covers. Luca is not there. Panic rises in her throat.
Luca!
She checks her own bed again without meaning to, and then the surrounding beds as well. As if her child is an item she's unthinkingly misplaced. A cell phone, a book, a pair of glasses. There's a window on the door that leads to the corridor, and a rectangle of light shining through it. Lydia, without shoes or a bra, bolts towards a patch of light. This is Luca's third trip to the bathroom since they got into bed a few hours ago. The murky lemonade returns. Being on the top bunk has made his frequent sprints to the toilet extra challenging, but Mommy's so exhausted that she never wakes, not even when he nearly steps on her shoulder as he clambers down, not even when he lands with an indelicate thump just inches from her head. Not even as he runs. The prickly imbalanced gait of the diuretically infirm from bunk to bathroom and back again. He's just washed his hands and returned to the fluorescent light of the hallway when he sees Padre Rey and Nestor talking to a young man in the doorway of the men's bunk room. Luca recognizes the young man as a migrant who arrived late that afternoon before dinner. He's wearing long red shorts and a white t-shirt, socks but no shoes, and he's carrying his backpack in front of him, unzipped. There's a pair of clean, expensive white sneakers on the floor beside him.
At least let me get dressed first, he says. Man, this is bullshit. You're supposed to help people.
Nestor steps behind him into the darkened interior of the dorm room, between the man and the sleeping migrants beyond. We can talk further, but not here. You are disturbing the whole facility, Padre Rey says calmly. Please, just come with us to the main room, where we can talk without waking everyone.
This is bullshit, Padre. That puta is lying, the man says, raising his voice to a shout. Bullshit!
Inside the dorm room, several men get out of their bunks and stand alongside Nestor, creating a kind of wall. They cross their arms, plant their legs wide. Luca stays frozen in his spot beside the bathroom door. He should turn and go the other way. He should scoot down the hall and back to the women and children's room. He should climb back up past Mommy's head and settle himself into the covers, where he should allow his body, temporarily relieved of stomach cramps, to rest. But he's paralyzed, transfixed. He's unaware of his own racing pulse, his shallow breath, his fingers scrabbling into the smooth seams between the painted cinder blocks of the wall behind him.
¡Chinga tu madre! The young man yells. Let's go, hermano.
It's the first time Luca has heard Nestor use his voice. It's as solidly built as his body.
Don't make it harder than it has to be.
The young man stoops and grabs his sneakers with one hand as Nestor and the other men close the distance behind him, encouraging him into the hallway without touching him. When he straightens to follow Padre Rey down the corridor, Luca notes the shape of a sickle tattoo with three blood-red droplets on the blade jutting out from the man's sock. It's carved into the calf muscle of his right leg. Luca doesn't know what the tattoo means exactly, but he doesn't need to understand it for it to amplify his sense of dread. That bloody sickle unsticks Luca from the wall and sends him dashing down the hallway back to the women's dorm. He runs bang into Mommy as he barrels through the door.
Luca, she says. Oh my God, Luca, where were you?
She doesn't wait for an answer. Her hands are on his shoulders, and she places him farther inside the room before sticking her head out into the hallway to see what all the noise is about. But all she can see is Nestor and a few other men following Padre Rey toward the front of the building. She goes back inside and allows the door to click shut behind her. Luca is trembling.
What happened?
She whispers. He shakes his head.
But what was all the shouting about?
He shakes again, and his face looks all carved up with worry.
It's okay, she says. It's okay, it's okay.
She pulls him into her arms and crushes his head against her chest. His little arms reach around behind her and cling. They stay like that until she lifts him under the armpits. He's too big for it, and his weight is enough that she struggles beneath it. But he wraps his legs around her waist, and she carries him back to their bunk. He doesn't go up to the top bed this time. She makes her body into a shield behind and around him. She wraps one arm and leg over the top of his small figure, makes her breath deep and slow for him, so that his breath will line up with hers, so that he'll rest and sleep. But Lydia stays vigilant until morning. Chapter 13. The first time a head turned up by itself on the street in Acapulco, it was a big deal. It was a 22-year-old head, with curly black hair shaved close on the sides and left long on top. It had a small gold hoop earring in its right ear. Its eyelids swelled, and its tongue protruded from its mouth. It was left on top of a public phone booth outside Pizza Hut, right next to the Diana Cazadora fountain. Rolled up and stuck in the corner of its mouth like a cigarette was a note that read, Me gusta hablar. I like to talk. The woman who found the head as she walked home from her shift as a night nurse at the Hospital del Pacifico was not a woman ordinarily horror-struck by the sight of blood. But that day, just as dawn tipped its westerly light across the pavements of Acapulco, causing the head to throw its queer, bodiless shadow from atop the phone booth and toward the feet of that weary nurse, she screamed, dropped her purse, and ran three blocks before retrieving her phone from her pocket and calling the police. The officers descended. The media swarmed. People passing through the area on their way to work or school were aghast. They took the time to get down on their knees and bless themselves, to offer up some thorough prayers on behalf of the anonymous soul who had once belonged to that head. It was famous. Until the second one.
By the time the head count reached a dozen, a shameful self-protective apathy began to spread in the gut of the city, so that in the mornings, when a call would come in that a head had been found, on the beach or at El Zócalo, or on the green of the ninth hole at El Club de Golf, the dispatcher answering the phone would sometimes make a joke. "Go for the putter. That hole is an easy par three." Back then, Sebastián had been the first one to recognize it for what it was, the city's steep, wholesale descent into the maw of the warring cartels. While other journalists were reluctant to acquiesce to the truth of their collapsing reality, Sebastián shouted it from his headlines. "Cartels exhibit brutal surge in violence. Terror and impunity. Cartels get away with murder." And most dramatically, after a particularly bad weekend, which saw the murders of two journalists, a city councilwoman, three shopkeepers, two bus drivers, a priest, an accountant, and a child holding a cob of buttered corn on the beach, his sandy feet still damp from the ocean, a simple pronouncement in 2-inch letters: Acapulco falls. That Monday morning, Lydia sat behind her register in the bookshop reading her husband's unflinching account of the weekend's murders while her tea turned cold and bitter in its cup. She'd found it particularly difficult to leave Luca at the school gate that morning. She'd gripped his tiny hand with ferocity and rubbed the bumps of his knuckles with her thumb while they walked. Luca had pretended not to notice, but he'd swung his lunchbox more vigorously than usual. When she kissed him goodbye at the gate, she spotted a powdering of dried toothpaste along his bottom lip. She licked her thumb and smeared it away, while he protested the gesture as asqueroso, gross. Perhaps he had a point, but he'd kissed her back anyway, his lips all gloppy and wet, and for once Lydia didn't discreetly wipe away the trail he left on her cheek. For once, she didn't turn and hurry off the moment he darted past the principal and into the courtyard. She waited there instead, one hand flat against the cinder block wall, and gazed after him. She didn't turn away until his light green and white uniform became invisible amid a sea of others. To Lydia, the change had felt sudden, lurching. She'd gone to bed the night before in the same city where she'd been born and raised, where she'd lived her entire life except for the brief spin of years through college in Mexico City. Her dreams had been populated by the same whipped current of ocean air, the same bright liquid colors, the same thrumming beats and aromas of her childhood, the same languorous swaying of hips that had always defined the pace of life here in this place she knew so well. Sure, there had been new violence, an unfamiliar hitch of anxiety. Sure, crime was on the rise. But until that morning, the truth had felt insulated beneath the illusory film of Acapulco's previous immunity. And then Sebastián's headline had ripped that protective skin away. All at once, the people had to look and to see. They could pretend no longer. Acapulco falls. Briefly, Lydia hated her husband for that headline. She hated his editor. "I mean, it's a little melodramatic, don't you think?" she challenged him when he stopped by the shop to pick her up for lunch. She flipped the sign to Cerrado and then locked the door behind them. Sebastián frowned at her. "Actually, I don't think it can be melodramatic enough. I don't think words exist that can sufficiently capture the atrocity of what's happening here." He slung his hands into his pockets and watched her face as they walked. He spoke carefully, endeavoring to suppress the accusatory note in his voice, but it was there. She could hear it. "You don't agree that it's unspeakably horrific?" A kind of mild repressed superiority. "I mean, of course I do, Sebastián. It's insane." She dropped her keys into her bag and wouldn't meet his eye. "But Acapulco falls? Like Rome is burning? I mean, look around. It's a regular day. The sun is shining. Look, there are tourists." She nodded toward a cafe on the corner where a group of rowdy estadounidenses sat at an outdoor table in the shade of an awning. There were several nearly empty carafes of wine on their table.
We should get one of those, Sebastian said.
And though it was not yet noon, Lydia agreed, and they mostly drank their lunch that day instead of eating it. She cut her eyes at him across the table and did not say the things she wanted to say. That it was asinine of him to write the stuff, that he was turning himself into a target, that she wanted no part of his righteous campaign of truth, that she hoped he was satisfied with his byline and that it was worth the danger. She did not say, "You are a father, you are a husband," but he felt all of it there, in the angle of her gaze across the table. And he didn't respond by condemning her lack of courage. He didn't bristle against her resentment or pick at the waiting scab. He knew her vigilance was not a shortcoming. He held her hand across the table and studied his menu in silence. "I think I'll have the soup," he said. That was more than a year and a half before she'd met Javier. But thinking back on it now, from the bottom bunk of the women's room at the Casa del Migrante in Huehuetoca, with Luca sleeping heavily on her arm, she wonders if Javier had anything to do with those first heads, if he saw them or sanctioned them, if he swung the weapon responsible for severing one of them from its body. Of course he did, she thinks. He must have. What was once inconceivable now seems foolishly plain. Por Dios, how would her life be different at this very moment if she'd accepted that truth sooner? There was a time once, perhaps a year ago, when a customer came into her shop on a windy day, his hair tossed up in a mess and his cheeks reddened by the wind. A shiver of animation skated in on his shoulders. He was agitated and spoke quickly to Lydia. There'd been a shooting a few blocks away. Some men had pulled up on a motorcycle and shot a local journalist 12 times in the head. The man was still lying there dead in the street. "Who was it? Who was it?" The customer shook his head. "I don't know. Some reporter." Lydia bolted. She grabbed her cell phone and ran outside. She left the man standing at her counter unattended. She left without ringing up his purchases. She hid Sebastian's number while she ran down the street, straight to voicemail. She panicked and cried out. When she got to the corner, she realized she didn't know which way she was running. Where was the shooting? Which street? She turned in circles, hit redial, straight to voicemail. The shopkeepers were standing in their doorways. "Where was it?" she asked the shoe store owner, and she hit Sebastian's number for a third time. Voicemail. The shoe salesman pointed and Lydia ran. She turned another corner, and another, hitting redial all the time. She called out for directions as she ran, and people pointed, and she kept going, and she kept hitting redial, and she kept running, and then she stopped when she got to the street where La Policia were just pulling up, where a crowd of onlookers had gathered in a clump around the body. She stopped because she didn't want to go any closer. She didn't want to see. Her husband lying there in the puddle of his spent life. Her thumb was cold as she redialed Sebastian's number 3 more times. Voicemail. She was crying before she approached, her hair stringing across her face in the wind, collecting her tears. She clasped the cell phone with both hands in front of her. She walked the double yellow line like it was the plank of a ship, her legs wilty beneath her. And then it was not him. There was so much blood that it was at first difficult to ascertain, but within a few moments she could see clearly. No, those were not his shoes. No, Sebastian's hair was not that length. His legs were not that thick. Oh my God, the relief. It was not him. She cried harder and harder. It was not him. A stranger scooped Lydia into her big, doughy arms then and held her while she cried. The woman was enormous and smelled of powder,
and Lydia did not resist her emphatic embrace. Nor did she correct the woman's assumption that her breakdown was caused by some familiarity with the deceased reporter. After all, that notion did feel approximately true. So Lydia allowed the stranger to comfort her, to murmur over her tears, to offer her the kindness of a tissue from the pocket of her sweater, and in a few minutes, it was all over. For Lydia. It was some other widow's turn that day. And when she finally extracted herself from the stranger's arms, Lydia's body felt jerky and clattery with adrenaline as she walked the several blocks back to her shop to find that her customer had left his money, plus a little extra, on the counter beside the register. She's still afraid that one day it will be Sebastian. She's been afraid for so long that now she can't catch up to the facts. It was already him and the rest of her family. It really did happen. All those years of worry did not prevent it. And not only Sebastian, but Mama too, and Yemi, and her beautiful children. And none of them had chosen to marry Sebastian or to take on the risks of his profession as their own. Only she had done that, and now her family had paid for her choice. The fears of her past and the horrors of her present are so mixed up, they feel like unmatching pieces of a rompecabezas, like she's trying to piece together things that were never meant to fit. Perhaps she's not ready. Lydia knows the stages of grief, and this is denial. Instead of acceptance, she wants to recall Sebastian's face, lunch that day in the cafe, the boyish tilt of his posture at the small table after their first glass of wine. They'd laughed together, and Sebastian had made a show of looking discreetly down her top, of rubbing her thigh beneath the table, of asking if she wanted to head back to the shop early so he could help her check inventory. But in the slick heat of the memory that follows, she cannot conjure Sebastian's face. The absolute absence of him feels like unmitigated terror. Lydia is startled by the lateness of the daylight when she opens her eyes, and for a moment, she doesn't know where she is. Luca is already awake beside her, watching her, his black eyes clear through the curtain of his sleep-sticky lashes. She can smell something cooking, and there's the distant clinking of forks against dishes. Come on, let's get some food. She sits up, but then leans back and presses her lips against the warm expanse of Luca's cheek. There's such comfort there that she stays for a minute, her hands against the softness of his skin. Luca sits bolt upright in bed, his hands flying up to his head to confirm what he already knows, that Papi's hat is not there. He wears it even when he sleeps now. And when he has to remove it to shower, he makes Lydia hold it in her hands until he comes out. She's not allowed even to set it down. Neither is she allowed to put it on her own head, because it must maintain the precise smell of Papi mingled with Luca, a mix that Luca is very pleased to note has not diminished, but only intensified in the time he's been wearing it. Perhaps Papi's smell is also his smell, and he can keep enhancing it by its continued use. They mustn't accidentally introduce any new ingredients, therefore, to corrupt the purity of the hat. It must have fallen off last night, when he was sleeping or during one of his many trips up and down from the top bunk to the bathroom. Don't worry, mijo, Lydia says, sitting up after him, because it's immediately evident what he's looking for. And he's already left the warm nest of the bottom bunk and clambered up to riffle through the top bunk. The bed frame squeaks as he digs through the covers. There's an audible sigh of relief from above. And then the hat appears, perched triumphantly on the end of Luca's outstretched arm over the edge of the bed. There are plenty of jóvenes, teenagers, at the shelter, but only a few younger children. And at breakfast, they all sit together at a round table in the center of the room. A little girl pops up from this table when Luca enters and draws him by the elbow to an empty seat. Lydia makes him a plate, and one for herself, and then sits at a table nearby with two other women, Nelly and Julia, both in their early 20s, both from Guatemala. Nelly is pudgy with curly hair. Julia is slender, with dark skin and almond-shaped eyes. Lydia nods and smiles politely as they introduce themselves, but she keeps quiet, afraid of her own voice, afraid she'll betray herself in some way she hasn't considered. Her accent, a turn of phrase, some unconscious custom that might identify her. She does not reach for the loops at her neck. Nelly and Julia recognize caution, and they understand. They don't press her. Lydia turns her face toward her plate, briefly closes her eyes, and blesses herself. Nelly and Julia resume their conversation.
She wasn't even going to tell anyone? Nelly asks. God bless her. Said she didn't want to make a fuss. It's only because I happened to step into the hallway just at that moment, Julia says. And I saw it with my own eyes. I saw what he did to her. I chased him away from her and then got the padre right away. And what did the padre do?
Nelly wants a play-by-play. She's taking her time with her food, shredding a tortilla into host-sized pieces, which she places on her tongue, one at a time.
The padre was great. He went in and fished that cholo right out of his cot, sent him packing. And I slept through the whole thing?
Nelly seems disappointed.
I heard he put up a bit of a fight, too.
Across the room, the girl at the center of last night's scandal, a 16-year-old from San Salvador, keeps her face tipped down toward her own plate. Her shoulders are rolled in so far toward each other that her body seems to be trying to swallow itself. Lydia chews even though the eggs are scrambled and the chewing is unnecessary. Her mouth needs something to do. Another woman approaches their table and points to the empty chair beside Lydia. Nelly waves her hand to indicate that it's free. The woman sets her plate down and pulls out the chair. She's wearing a pink skirt and flip-flops and has a multicolored ribbon woven into the two long braids down her back. If her clothing didn't mark her as an indigenous woman, then her heavily accented Spanish would. Nelly and Julia steal glances at each other as the woman takes her seat. She smiles at them and offers her name as Ixchel. But Nelly and Julia continue their conversation without pause, turning their bodies almost imperceptibly away from her. It's a rudeness that Lydia would have endeavored to counteract in her whole life, with a smile and a kind word, perhaps even a rebuke to the offending party. Because Lydia perceives that the Guatemalan women are snubbing the newcomer due to bigotry, because she's an India. And Lydia is suitably offended on Ixchel's behalf. But performing an act of decorum would mean putting herself at risk. So instead, she keeps her eyes on her plate, scoops some eggs into a tortilla.
I saw them together last night after dinner, Julia says. I saw the way he looked at her, and I just presumed they were together. But what I saw then after, there was no question it was one-sided.
She tried to fight him off?
Nelly asks, placing a speckled white square in her mouth.
Worse than that, she struggled, but then seemed resigned to it.
Julia shakes her head sadly, but there's a spiky anger in her voice.
Like she knew there was nothing she could do if he'd made up his mind. ¡Qué chingadera! They should be castrated, every one of them, Nelly says, shaking her head full of black curls.
Julia looks across at the young girl.
She's so pretty, too. She's going to have a rough journey. A lot of return trips to the Cuerpo Matico, Nelly agrees.
The what? Ixchel asks.
The Cuerpo Matico,
Nelly repeats. Ixchel shakes her head. She may have an accent, but her Spanish is excellent, and yet she hasn't heard this word before. Perhaps it's slang. Perhaps it's made up. Lydia doesn't know it either.
You don't know this word? Julia asks.
Ixchel shakes her head a second time. Lydia watches Luca at the round table while she listens to the women talk.
I thought all the Guatemaltecas knew it.
Nelly allows the remainder of her tortilla to wilt back onto her plate.
Las guanacas también, y las catrachas.
Julia leans forward on her elbows and pushes her plate aside. It means your body is an ATM machine. Lydia tries to swallow, but the eggs and tortilla have formed a paste in her mouth. Her fork is full of rice, a crispy disc of plátano frito speared onto its tines. The fork hovers.
This is the price of getting to El Norte, Nelly says.
After some excruciating measure of seconds, Ixchel finds her voice, the Spanish words that are familiar. La violación.
Rape is the price?
Both women look at her blankly. They cannot believe this is news to her. Has she been living under a rock before now?
How did you end up here, mamita?
Nelly asks, returning her attention to the food. Ixchel does not answer. Julia leans in and drops her voice low.
I have paid twice already.
This disclosure, shared with a woman she seemed to shun only moments ago, is such an unexpected intimacy that Lydia makes a noise in her throat without meaning to, a wound of a sound. All three women look at her as she takes a sip of fruit punch and sets her still full fork on the edge of her plate.
How about you?
Julia returns her attention to Nelly. Have you paid?
Not yet, Nelly says grimly.
You? They all look expectantly at Lydia. She shakes her head. A smiling young woman approaches the table where Luca is sitting with the other children.
Who's ready for a puppet show? She asks.
The little girl beside Luca shoots out of her chair, arms raised.
Me, me, she says.
Good, I need lots of helpers.
I heard he was a sicario.
This information snaps Lydia's focus back to her own table.
What?
She says accidentally.
That's the rumor, Julia shrugs. Seems like they should know better than to let those narcos in.
But he told the padre he was getting out, Nelly intercedes. Told him he got recruited by the cartel when he was just a kid, and he never had any choice. You know the story. Had enough of that life and wanted to go to El Norte.
Which cartel?
Ixchel asks, because like most people, because of her personal experience, she's more afraid of one particular cartel than others.
What does it matter? Nelly says. They're all the same. Animales.
They're not, Julia insists. Some of them are way worse than others.
Nelly makes a face like she's skeptical, but doesn't argue.
Like los jardineros, Julia says. I heard they donated money to build a new cancer hospital in Acapulco.
Lydia takes a sharp breath, but Nelly waves a hand dismissively.
That's just trying to buy people's loyalty, she says. Propaganda.
But maybe the reason is less important than the fact, Julia says.
Then she drops her voice to a whisper and leans in again, closing the space across the table to a tight circle. She names the unnameable cartel.
Los Zetas feed people their own body parts. Los Zetas hang babies from bridges.
Lydia covers her mouth with her hand. Her fingers are cold and stiff. And beside her, Ixchel is crossing herself. Lydia will ask a question now, but she'll make her voice light, neutral.
So last night, the guy who got kicked out, which cartel was he?
Julia shrugs.
I don't know, she says. But if he really wants out, he better run. Far and fast, right? They don't let those guys go.
Lydia pushes her plate away. Far and fast, she thinks. Some things are so simple. Chapter 14. 6 days and 282 miles from absolute calamity, Lydia and Luca take their leave from Huehuetoca and head north once again, following the trail of La Bestia. When Lydia considers how they've managed to survive the last week, to get this far from Acapulco and remain alive, her mind seizes. Because she knows she's made both good and bad decisions in those 6 days, and that ultimately, it's only by the grace of God that none of those choices have met with bad luck and resulted in catastrophe. That awareness incapacitates her. She can't conceive of a plan to board the train, which is what they must do. They must get on the train. Meanwhile, walking will give her time to think. They filled their canteens before they left the shelter, but they stop at a small shop down the road and Lydia jams her bag with snacks. Because it's a shop that's used to migrants, they stock the kinds of things that migrants can carry and eat. Nuts, apples, candy, granola, chips, carne seca. Lydia buys as much as she can fit in her pack. She buys a floppy hat too, pink with white flowers, to protect her neck from the sun. It reminds her of the ugly thing Mama used to put on when she gardened, and any time Lydia and Yemi caught their mother wearing it, they would titter and tease. You laugh, but this hat is the reason I have the skin of a 24-year-old, their mother would chide them. Back outside, the freight tracks stretch out across the Mexican landscape like a beanstalk migrants must climb, and Luca and Mami go step by step, tie by tie, leaf by leaf. The sun is bright, but not too hot this early in the day. They hold hands briefly, and then sweat and separate, and then the cycle repeats. They take the westernmost route because Luca's mind map was convinced that, though that way was longer than the others, the relative topography would be kinder if they end up making much of the journey by foot, as it appears they might. He's glad Mami didn't press him to explain his instinct. She simply yielded to the gentle pressure of his hand as they'd set off. Lydia knows that her plan to go to Denver is inadequate, that it might be difficult to track down her tío Gustavo. Abuela used to complain that her baby brother had turned into a gringo when he left for El Norte all those years ago, when he was still a young man, and never looked back. Lydia knows only that her tío married a white lady, changed his name to Gus, and started his own company, something in construction. Was it plumbing or electric? And what if he changed his last name too? She's never met his children, her primos Yankees. She doesn't even know their names. When she dwells too long on these facts, she begins to panic. So she strips it all back to manageable step-by-step pieces. Move north, reach the border, find a coyote, get across, take a bus to Denver. There will be churches there, libraries, internet access, immigrant communities, people willing to help. For now, just move north. Move north. Get Luca out of danger. A couple hours' walk northwest of the migrant shelter, Luca and Mami encounter two teenage sisters wearing matching rainbow wristbands on their slender left arms, sitting on an overpass above the train tracks and dangling their feet below. Both girls are very beautiful, but the slightly older one is dangerously so. She wears baggy clothing and an intense scowl in a failing effort to suppress that calamitous beauty. The younger one leans back on her stuffed backpack, but they both sit up when they see Luca. The studied hardness of their expressions melts. Together they make the, oh, of cuteness that teenage girls often emit for smaller children. Mira qué guapo, the younger sister sings out in an unfamiliar accent. So cute, the older one agrees. They both have abundant black hair, stark expressive eyebrows, dark penetrating eyes, perfectly aligned teeth, full lips, and apple-shaped cheeks. The older one has something extra, something undefinable that makes her entirely arresting. Luca fixes his eyes on her accidentally and cannot seem to remove his gaze once it's alighted upon her. Mommy does, too. The girl is so beautiful, she seems almost to glow, more colorful than the landscape in which she sits. The dingy gray of the concrete overpass, the pebble brown of the tracks and the earth, the faded blue of her baggy jeans, the dirty white of her oversized t-shirt, the bleached arc of the sky, it all recedes behind her. Her presence is a vivid throb of color that deflates everything else around her. An accident of biology. A living miracle of splendor. It's a real problem.
Oye, ¿a dónde van, amigos?
The less beautiful one calls out to them when they're directly beneath her feet.
Where everyone goes, Lydia says, shielding her eyes so she can look up at the girls above them. To el norte.
She removes the ugly pink hat from her head and uses it to fan herself. Beneath it, her sweaty hair sticks to her forehead.
Us too, she says, swinging her feet. Your son is so cute.
Lydia looks over at Luca, who's smiling up at the girls, the most genuine smile that has escaped his face since the morning of Jennifer's quinceañera.
My name is Rebecca, and this is my sister Soledad.
The girl speaks to Luca directly.
¿Cómo te llamas, chiquito?
Lydia, who's fallen into the habit of answering for her silent son, opens her mouth to reply, but...
Luca,
he says, his voice clear like a bell, no hint of rust from all those days without use. Lydia snaps her mouth shut in surprise.
How old are you, Luca?
Rebecca asks.
I'm 8 years old.
The sisters look at each other with animation, and the younger one claps her hands together.
I knew it! Just exactly the same age as our little cousin at home. His name is Juanito. He looks like you. Doesn't he look like Juanito, Sole?
Soledad, the beauty, smiles reluctantly.
He does, she admits. Like twins. You want to see his picture?
Rebecca asks. Luca looks at Mommy, who's been very cautious about stopping to talk with people. But these girls have returned her boy's voice to him. She nods.
Come up, Rebecca says.
She removes a fragile plastic bag of wrapped photographs from the front pocket of her sister's backpack and flips through them. Luca scrambles up to join the girls on the overpass while Mommy watches from below. She tries to survey their location, but the seam of land cut by the tracks here makes a poor vantage point for visibility, so she follows Luca up the steep, sandy little hill. The girls aren't actually sitting on the overpass at all, but on a metal grate that sticks off the roadway on one side of the overpass like a hazardous catwalk. Lydia tests it with her foot before stepping over. Luca squats on the roadway side, leaning his elbows on the low guardrail. Rebecca leans back against this, and together they stare at the pictures.
¿Sí?
She says.
Guapo como tú.
Luca grins again and nods.
He does look like me, mami. Look, he says, except no teeth.
Rebecca holds the photograph so Lydia can see. He lost those two both on the same day, and then he was like a vampire, the girl says to Luca.
Did you lose yours yet?
A potent memory. It looms up unbidden. Papi pulling his first tooth, a bottom one from the middle. The tooth had been loose for weeks, and then one night during dinner, Luca took a bite of his tampiqueña, and a point of pain shot through his gums. He dropped his fork, moved the food to the back of his mouth, swallowed it in an unchewed lump, and then examined the damage. The tooth, he found, had been pushed askew. It leaned like an ancient grave in soft ground. He touched it softly with one finger and was horrified by its slackness. Mommy and Papi both put down their forks to watch. But Luca was so afraid of the pain that he found himself unable to do anything. And then Mommy had tried, for perhaps 20 minutes, to coax him to open his mouth just a little so she could have a look. But Luca was steadfast and mute, his lips clamped shut. When Mommy finally lost her patience, Papi eased into place beside Luca. He made funny faces intended to illustrate what happened to children who didn't allow for the timely removal of ejected teeth. And Luca laughed despite his fear. And in the gap of that laughter, he finally submitted to opening his little mouth while Mommy watched from across the table. Papi reached in there so gently, Luca didn't even feel the presence of his fingers against the tooth. But he does remember Papi's hands along his face, one securely cupping his chin, the other reaching inside. Luca remembers the salty tang of Papi's fingers and the triumphant smile when those fingers emerged with the price of that tiny tooth. Luca's eyes popped so wide when he saw it, and he gasped. He couldn't believe there was no pain, no feeling at all. Papi had simply reached in there and lifted the little thing out. And then they all laughed and squealed at the table together, and Luca jumped out of his chair, disbelieving, and his parents both hugged and kissed him. He ate the rest of his tampiqueña while the new hole in his mouth gathered small pieces of food he had to sluice out with milk. That night, they left the tooth beneath his pillow, and El Ratoncito Pérez came to retrieve it, leaving Luca a poem and a new toothbrush in its place. Luca lifts one hand to his mouth now and sucks on his knuckle, but it's not the same, and he has to bat at that memory like a pesky bug, a horsefly. The gone taste of his father's hands. Mommy sees this, reaches out, and squeezes his toe through his sneaker, just a gentle pressure that brings him back to this dusty overpass. He breathes into his body. Couldn't get on the train, huh? Among other things, so